The Serenity Prayer, the prayer adapted by Alcoholics Anonymous, which we'll hear in a moment, is known around the world, but few people know its origins. It was written at the height of World War II by the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, who passionately opposed Hitler. Niebuhr is the author of the books Moral Man and Immoral Society and The Nature and Destiny of Man, which have been studied by many students of theology. My guest is Niebuhr's daughter, Elizabeth Sifton. She's written a new book called The Serenity Prayer that tells the story behind the prayer and discusses her late father's view of faith and politics in times of peace and war. Sifton is a senior vice president of the publishing company Farrar, Straus & Giroux. She's worked in publishing for 40 years, but this is her first time out as an author. Let's start with the Serenity Prayer.
God, give us grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed, courage to change the things that should be changed, and the wisdom to distinguish the one from the other.
Elizabeth Sifton, I've always really liked that prayer. I had no idea your father wrote it. I guess most people don't know your father wrote it.
Most people don't know. Many people think other people wrote it, or that it's so old that the origins are lost in the mists of time. He composed it in 1943 for a little village church in northwestern Massachusetts where he spent the summers.
One of the things I've always liked about that prayer is that there are things where I just can't tell if it's something that can be changed or if it's something I must learn to accept. And that gray area between what can be changed and what can't be changed has created considerable anguish in my life over the years.
Well, exactly so, and it does for, I think, all of us, or anybody who has any care for the meaning of their lives. That's the condition that's addressed in the third part of the prayer, a prayer for wisdom to distinguish what can be changed from, or what should be changed from what cannot be changed. I think my father felt, and he was a social activist and a very deeply committed Christian believer in trying to strive for social justice and improvement in ordinary people's lives, I think he felt that all too often people settled for the status quo thinking it couldn't be changed and did not give real thought to the possibility that it should be. He meant that as a personal thing, as you've mentioned. It's a matter of personal striving, but it's also a matter of social engagement and community care as well. The prayer became famous because shortly after it was written, it was composed, I should say. I don't exactly know how he scribbled it down. Prayers were very often for him simply spoken in a church service. But shortly after he had composed it, a friend of his, and also a person who attended this same small church in Massachusetts in the summer, Dean Howard Robbins of the National Cathedral in Washington, who was a big shot in the Federal Council of Churches, asked if he could use the prayer in a small pamphlet that was being prepared for use in the army. And so my father said, sure, use it for that. So the first published appearance of the prayer was in a little booklet prepared for servicemen in Europe. I met many soldiers in World War II who came to Union Theological Seminary, where my father taught in New York City, who became students of his after the war. He often said that they were some of the very best students he had ever had because they had faced deep crises of both personal and huge collective suffering and meaninglessness. War is so often grossly and catastrophically meaningless, and they wanted to search for some kind of meaning in their lives and also devote themselves to something comprehensively serious and attentive to human needs.
Now, your father wrote the Serenity Prayer during World War II. He was very opposed to Hitler. His father had come to the United States from Germany in the 1800s. How did the war connect to his writing of the Serenity Prayer?
Well, that was the question I asked myself, and I ended up writing a book that's a good bit longer than I expected in order to arrive at the answer. It seems to me that this issue, the issue of what should be, what must be accepted as something that one cannot change and what we must strive to improve or change or alter, and working at developing the wisdom to know the one thing from the other, that this way of looking at things had been sharply honed and developed and shaped during the years of the 1920s and 30s. In the 1920s, my father was a pastor in a working class and middle class congregation in Detroit, a city that was facing enormous social upheavals and difficulties with the development of the auto industries there. And in the 1930s, there was the Great Crash, and there was the rise of fascism and authoritarian and totalitarian regimes in Europe that threatened democracy and freedom everywhere. So the question of whether one opposed these developments and insisted that the drift toward accepting them be changed was a urgent one for him. So I think the formulation brings to a head his consideration of these anguished and difficult problems for more than 20 years.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Elizabeth Sifton, and she's the vice president of the publishing company Farrar, Straus, Giroux. She's just written her first book, and it's called The Serenity Prayer, and it's about the prayer and the history of the prayer that was written by her father, the late theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. What really popularized the Serenity Prayer, and I think the reason why so many people know it today, is that it was adopted by Alcoholics Anonymous as a prayer for people who were struggling to overcome their drinking. And I think, you know, other groups have taken it on too, and now it's just become very widely known. How was it adopted by Alcoholics Anonymous?
I don't have the documentary paper trail on this. I only know, my father told me this, my mother repeated it, that at some point, I think in the late 40s, after the war, they simply wrote and asked him if they could use it, and he said sure. Similarly, Hallmark cards had also asked him if they could use it, and he had said sure. The fact that they simplified it, omitting the grace, for example, from the first sentence.
When you say they, are you talking about AA?
AA, excuse me. I don't know whether they did that deliberately or it just happened. Prayers, after all, get spoken even more perhaps than they get read. And as they're passed around, they may just get a bit streamlined. But in any case, the AA version, which simply says, not give us, but give me serenity to accept the things that cannot be changed, et cetera, et cetera. They may have just done that in the course of things, not with a deliberate intention to alter it in any way.
It shocks me to hear that your father was willing to allow Hallmark to use the prayer for greeting cards. I mean, that's in some ways, with no offense to Hallmark, but in some ways, everybody's worst fear is that like a wonderful piece of poetry or a profound literary statement will be used as like a little bumper sticker or a greeting card or something, and even though the words are the same, somehow it will be trivialized in that context.
I think he felt that, yes, it might be, and probably would be, but that it was not for him to determine that it should be controlled and kept pure or highbrow in some way. Mm-hmm. He didn't think of prayers like that. Prayers were written and composed and spoken from the heart for everyone, and one didn't control their use. Who was he to say how people would find it meaningful for them? So I think he just let it happen. It that's very much part of his general ecumenical view that grace and serenity and courage and wisdom come to everyone in all walks of life in different parts of the world at different times, and it is not for him to say who should or should not use this prayer. He never, ever would have thought of copywriting it or asking for royalties on it, which often people jokingly say to me he should have done. It's an all-American thing, I suppose, to want to make money from anything one has done that has been in the least bit successful, but that would have appalled him.
So Hallmark never paid him for the use of the Serenity Prayer?
Not that I know of. They might have paid him a fee just at the beginning, but I don't know. That was in the 40s when I was a baby, and I don't actually know, and I have no record of it.
What are some of the most unusual or interesting contexts you've seen the Serenity Prayer used in or reprinted in?
Well, there are many kitschy versions. I mean, it's funny to find it on book plates or on coffee mugs. Well, of course, that's inevitable for, in this day and age. I have a T-shirt with it on. But the most interesting, you asked, I know about is not one that I've actually personally seen. But my friend Joseph Lelieveld of the New York Times, when he was correspondent for the New York Times in South Africa, saw the prayer quite often on a plaque hanging on a kitchen or living room wall in many black townships in Soweto and so on. And that moved me greatly to think, and it would have pleased my father to know that this prayer was of use to the black communities of South Africa in the terrible years of apartheid. But Joe also pointed out to me that he saw the prayer also on the walls of white supremacist apartheid supporters in South Africa, which suggests that whatever side you're on, you feel that it's appropriate for you.
You write about how one of the things that your father and many of his friends tried to puzzle through was where religion should fit in the public life of a country that was founded on the principle of separation of church and state. What were some of the ideas that your father had on that subject?
My father felt very strongly that the separation of church and state was an important and principle that must be attended to. More than saying what he thought the government should do about this, he was concerned with the health of the churches and the way the churches would approach this matter. He felt all too often that Protestant and Catholic and other clerics were hungry themselves for power and influence, and therefore compromised their distance from the powers that be by sucking up to them, by enjoying access to privilege and governmental power when they should keep their distance from it.
And it sounds like he also thought that the church should often challenge that power.
That's right. He felt that it was a part of the great Christian tradition to derive their understanding of the church's role in modern society the way the prophets in the Old Testament spoke of it, that there must be a distance kept from the temptations and evils of I don't mean evils of secular society because secularism is evil. I mean the dangers of partisan and selfish and over-commercialized activities. The church should stay clear of these and not succumb to them. He also was very skeptical of ministers who became famous for their close association with political figures. He would say of them that they were always trembling on the abyss of exhibitionism. Exhibitionism is what many secular and agnostic and atheist people think that ministers first and foremost are, and I can't blame them.
Your father was critical in his time of both the left and the right. Can you describe what his criticisms of each were?
His criticism of the left, where he belonged himself, really, because he was a social progressive and cared tremendously for the issues of social justice and the betterment of all lives in any community, which I believe is a left position. His criticism of the left in the 20s and 30s and even into the 40s and 50s and 60s was that they tended to be cheerfully and rather stupidly optimistic about the chances for improvement and betterment, that they adopted what he called simplistic enlightenment ideas about progress of mankind, if only people are rational and good to each other and so on. And he thought the record of human history shows that this is absolutely not realistic, that there must be a deeper and better understanding of what makes people act the way they do and why there is so much evil and harm in the world must be interpreted in a more demanding and complicated way than many liberals did, who would just preach, I say preach even if they weren't ministers, preach self-improvement and betterment if only people were smarter or nicer or more rational or more sensible, or if only this would happen or that would happen. The most hubristic, simplistic attitude on the left that he deplored was, of course, the communist one. He was vehemently anti-communist on very Christian grounds. He thought it was a godless and hubristic idea to think that it was within the power of human beings to reorganize their society in such a way as to make everything come out right in the end, which the communists assured their followers their regimes could do. So that was his criticism of the left.
What about his criticism of the right?
His criticism of the right was deeper and more complete and more constant, because the right was so much in power and at the helm, even during the New Deal, which challenged the right-wing orthodoxies of American economic life. He felt that wealthy and powerful people who control the levers of power and economic ownership of the means of production, to use the Marxist phrases, that these people had absolutely no regard, or very little regard, or insufficient regard for the welfare of everyone, and particularly of workers and of the less fortunate than they. That in a very big, dynamic, competitive, capitalist society like America, there was not any attention being paid on the right to the ordinary issues of social justice and economic fairness. He wrote somewhere that rich princes always imagine that they are wise. They imagine that they think they're wise because they're powerful and at the top of the heap, and it never occurs to them that they're only there because they have all the money, not because they are wiser than anyone else. So he inveighed constantly against the powers that be that he felt were unjust and indifferent to suffering.
Your parents had an interfaith marriage. I mean, it wasn't totally interfaith, but it was mild on the scale of what interfaith means.
But
your mother was Episcopalian, and your father's church was
the Evangelical and Reformed Church, which was a small denomination founded by Germans in the 19th century, and eventually merged with the Congregationalists, and they're now called the United Church of Christ.
Did your parents have disagreements about faith or about worship?
Not about faith, I think, but certainly about worship. They had quite strong disagreements about worship. My mother, as an Anglican, she was English and had been raised in the Anglican communion in England, was very liturgical. She believed in the great liturgy laid down in the Book of Common Prayer. My father was an evangelical. He believed that prayer and worship must come, as it were, spontaneous. You must open up your heart and spirit, and as the Spirit moves you, you pray. However, he greatly admired the liturgical communions, as he called it, the liturgical churches, for establishing a kind of discipline over these prayers, because he thought that it was important for ministers and the congregation to understand that prayers couldn't be and worship couldn't be a time for personal blandishments and show-off times, and that it was important to adhere to some sort of discipline of worship that the regular liturgies provided. However, in given instances, my father and my mother would argue about these things.
Did your mother find it strange that your father wrote prayers?
I think she thought it was dangerous.
Dangerous?
Dangerous because one could often just go off into he never did, of course. She deeply loved him and admired and loved him for his spiritual depth and precision of expression in his prayers. But I think she thought it was dangerous to just improvise prayers, because you could always make a fool of yourself. She was a rather stringent and caustic person in these matters.
Now, you write in your book that there was a period in your late adolescence when you had a crisis of faith. What was your crisis about?
My crisis was about, it came about at in a very simple way. I was attending, one summer, I was in England, and I attended a sung evensong, which is a very beautiful service, a daily service, sung by the choirs usually in the great cathedrals of England. And I was attending a sung evensong at Winchester Cathedral, where my parents had actually been married. And the church is sensationally beautiful, and the choir is very good, and the service was almost unbearably beautiful. And then I realized that I was worshiping the beauty of the service itself. I had become, as I said to my father later, a hellish aesthete. I was just enjoying the service for the service, and I wasn't really paying attention to the meaning of it. I have a feeling that this happens a lot in services of any kind that the congregants will enjoy. They're just enjoying the service more than they're thinking about what the service is for.
So it doesn't sound like it shattered your faith or anything.
Well, I thought to myself, I don't know if I believe this whole story. I don't know if I believe this man who, this itinerant rabbi in Palestine, was actually godly, a deity. I don't know if I believe any of this. I'm pretty sure I don't literally believe in the virgin birth. I'm not sure I literally believe in the resurrection. I'm not sure I believe in any of this. This is maybe, I've been sort of riding along on a tide of acceptance of something that I've known all my life, but that maybe it's all hooey. I was studying a lot of 18th century French Enlightenment thought at the time, and that, of course, encouraged me to be anti-clerical. But it just suddenly struck me as a kind of implausible story from the start, and I ought to distance myself from it. So I did.
Where are you now on that?
Ambivalent. That is to say, I think of myself as a Christian, and I think of myself as a Protestant. I think of myself as somebody whose spiritual and intellectual life has been formed by an acceptance of the deep meaning of the stories in the Gospels. And I find them deeply beautiful and meaningful, and I think I believe them. But as I tried to write about, I was brought up to believe that accepting unbelief, accepting a difficulty in belief, was part of a true religious enterprise. That working at one's spiritual life is difficult, and there are many steps backward, and it's never easy. And so there are moments of lapses and moments of failure, and then you must try again. And so I had been taught that really good Christians accepted these failures and forgave you for them.
You are the vice president of Farrar, Straus, Giroux, the publishing house, and you've been in publishing your whole adult life. This is the first book you've written, and I guess I'm wondering why it's taken you so long to write a book.
Oh, because I didn't have time to write a book. Helping others get their books published was more than enough work for me. And I also didn't have a subject that I wanted to write about. When I was in college, I studied both history and literature. I never focused on one historical or political issue or type of work, nor did I with literary work. And it's been a joy for me as a publisher to work in both fields. And I'm a generalist. I never had a particular subject I wanted to write about. But then, wishing to clarify the history of this beautiful prayer and its enormous popularity gave me my subject. So I wrote it then. It's an amazing thing to write a book after you've helped so many other people see a book being published. It's very different from the other side of the desk, I'll tell you.
What are some of the differences?
Here's a very simple one. If a writer gives me, as an editor, a manuscript to look at, and I say I'll get to it right away, I mean that I'll get to it within the week, right? Or as soon as I can, and there are 55 million other things I've got to do. Of course, I know that every writer wants to be thought of as the editor's sole responsibility for the moment, but I always tried to say, listen, I'm not sure I can read that till next Tuesday, you know. And then the writer would say, oh, yes, I understand that. Well, as a writer, I cannot understand why people don't call me within 20 minutes of reading my book. the 24 hours maximum. That's one example. The writing and editing of it was not so different in a way. The late Laurie Colwin, who was a friend and colleague of mine, said once, when asked the same question about writing and editing and the differences, she said that she always looked at other people's prose as if it were her own, and addressed the editorial problems with care as if they were her own. But she tried to read her own prose as if it was somebody else's, ruthlessly, you know. And I tried to do the same.
Elizabeth Sifton, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Elizabeth Sifton's new book is called The Serenity Prayer. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. This is NPR, National Public Radio.